Hey, thanks for listening to the podcast today. I hope you enjoy it. But first, I want to ask you a question. Are you someone who has high upside potential in your business, and yet sometimes that goal is just hard to get to, and maybe the only way you've seen to get to it is just to make more calls, you know, work harder? Well, if you're fed up with using old strategies to solve new problems, then I might have a solution. It's my 5-day Million Dollar Seller Challenge. We meet 1 hour a day in a coaching intensive where I will teach you 5 moves that you can make to scale your results without working harder. To learn more, click the link in the show notes or go to milliondollarsellerchallenge.com.
The main reason why people are uncomfortable and are not able to simply spout out a simple answer to a simple question is because if I tell you what I want my life to look like in 5 years, I know what's going to happen next, and I'm not going to like it. What's going to happen next is you're going to tell me what I have to do in year 4, 3, 2, and 1. And then you're going to tell me what I have to do in months 12 through 1. And then you're going to tell me what I have to do tomorrow. And right now, my calendar is sort of fairly open. You know, I've got work. I just will do tomorrow pretty much like what I did today.
On today's episode, I interview Rabbi Daniel Lappin, who was a guest of mine many years ago, and I ask him to come back. And in this interview, he talks about the value of blue-collar work, why being detached to reality can really make you stronger, why all the drama in the world really shouldn't make much difference in your life. And he also talks about some Jewish and biblical perspectives on wealth creation and why we're so reluctant to think of our vision. Rabbi Lappin has written several books, including Thou Shall Prosper, that's my favorite, Business Secrets of the Bible, and his brand new one, The Holistic You. I think you'll enjoy this interview. Today, I'm blessed to have Rabbi Daniel Lappin with me. We interviewed him on the Advanced Selling Podcast many years ago. We will make sure that episode gets put in the show notes so you can go back and listen to it. But Rabbi Lappin, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. This is such a nice opportunity to get back together again. It's been much too long.
A lot has changed in the 12 years.
Well, you know, one of my slogans in my podcast is that the more that things change, the more we need to depend on those things that never change.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
really what we're talking about today.
Yeah. So let's start here with a question that I kind of tipped you off that I was going to ask before we rolled. And that was, I'd like to get your sense, because you have a pulse of people in the general society and the cultural and some of the ills that we're facing. What is your sense? You know, I hear a lot about mental health and depression and anxiety, and you hear fentanyl and overdoses, and there's a lot of media storm around that. What is your sense of the general well-being of the population today, whether it's in America or North America or globally? You've probably got some kind of opinion on that. What is it?
There's a part A and a part B, Bill. Part A is that there are two Americas, and in one America, it isn't good. In the other America, it's much better. And part B is that regardless of what's happening on the macro, whether we're talking about politics or demonstrations and protests or international insecurities, the important thing to remember is that when it comes down to the 5 primary focuses of people's lives, those things can still be grown and developed regardless of whatever is happening on the macro. So first of all, you know, there really are two Americas, Bill. There's an America where people earn their living and work primarily with words and ideas. And then there's an America where people work mostly with things. And in the America where people work mostly with things, the nice thing about things is that they keep you attached to reality, and they remind you, most importantly, of natural restraints and restrictions that exist in the world. So what I mean by that, for instance, is if a carpenter wants to drive a large hole through a 2x4 in order to run a conduit, he's going to discover that he's weakened the strength of that 2x4 substantially by putting a big hole in the middle of it. And so he realized, hey, you know what? You can't do that. or if a you know, if a guy working on an engine says, you know what, I can afford to be sloppy here. This bolt is actually metric, but I'm going to replace it with an imperial thread bolt. It's not going to be a problem. Well, it is going to be a problem. And so guys like that, you know, the guys operating the crane on the construction site and the rigger organizing a truckload, these guys live in a world of reality. And as a result of that, being attached to reality makes you much less susceptible to, let's call it the mental stresses. That is on the side of the America where people work with ideas and words, and that includes academia, entertainment, politics, education, the journalism, particularly, all in that area. When you come to ideas and words, there are no natural restraints. Your imagination is unlimited, and so, not surprisingly, people develop ideas that are detached from reality. And I don't mean to be political and bother anybody, because I try not to offend inadvertently. I mean, when I offend, it's deliberate. You know, to come up with an idea that there's no difference between men and women, you have to be so much detached from reality for that. Mm-hmm. You just got to be. And so people in that world where there are no natural restraints and no natural reminders that there is a reality in which we function tend to suffer disproportionately from these things. And and the final point on that is also that the handbook of mental disease is called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychology, and that is grown. You remember what a phone book was, Bill?
Sure.
Well, the Manhattan phone book looked like that. Mm-hmm. It was that thick, you know. Well, the DSM started off as a thin book, and it's now a very fat book. So the number of things that are listed has been grown, and every one of those items in that fat book has a payment schedule for insurance payments.
Oh.
And in a lot of these things, follow the money is not a bad tip.
Not at all.
I'm trying to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And then as far as the B part of my answer is concerned, regardless of some of the craziness going on, both internally and also externally, regardless of that, you know, each and every one of us can still focus on our families, on our finances, on our friendships, our social life, on our physical fitness, and for those who are open to it and realize its benefits, their faith.
Yeah,
and that's what I believe, that, you know, the most value people like you and I bring to our clients and our audience is the reminder that it's very easy to become distracted by what one perceives as, oh, the, you know, the world is coming to an end. Well, I don't dispute that many times historic things are happening, but one thing I do assure you is the world is not coming to an end. It may even be possible that America's primacy is coming to an end. You know, epochs and empires typically last about 250 years, whether it's for the Babylonians or the pre-Tsarist Russians or the French or the Mamelukes or the Ottomans. It's always about 250 years. And, you know, we're at year number 248 now. And before us was the British Empire, and that ran from 1700 to about 1950, post-war years, the loss of India in 47. And so, again, you know, the world's reserve currency used to be the pound sterling until 1944. It then became the dollar. It's quite possible that it's not going to remain the dollar.
Yeah.
You know, it might become a cryptocurrency. I don't think that's likely. It might become the Chinese yuan. Who knows? But it's not going to make any difference. England is not the master of the world. There is no English Empire. It's been gone for 70 years. But England is still an okay place to live. You can still function there just fine.
Yeah.
And that's why I say to people, look, you know, don't worry too much. Don't stress on what's going on the macro. It's going to happen anyway, but you can still work on your priorities.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, I think you were talking about the crane. This is a great answer. You're talking about the crane operator. And I think that people who work with their hands and with things, they tend to have a belief or kind of an orientation to unintended consequences. So if I lift this thing, oh, that's going to cause me to have to lift this again, and I don't have enough, you know, counterweight in the back of my crane. I don't think our leaders spend nearly enough time on unintended consequences. And so they make these policies, and it all sounds good at the time. And I mean, there's lots of examples, and a lot of them are political, which we won't get into, but it just seems to be a lack. And it's the same with people. I don't think we always think about what's the unintended consequence of eating a Blizzard from Dairy Queen every night for 5 years. Well, it feels good in the moment, but at some point I'm gonna be big and unhealthy. And it was just a series of those behaviors that I really didn't take into account. What are the consequences of that?
Yeah. No, when I'm in charge, Bill, I'm going to make sure that that people who attend university are disqualified for Congress, the Senate, and the presidency. No, seriously. I mean, the more time nowadays, particularly, it's becoming clear you're being miseducated, not educated. And so I want to see tradesmen. I want to see guys who work with things ruling us. Today, the proportion of Americans that attend college is about a third of the proportion of members of the Congress who've attended college. We are being governed by people who are not like us.
Yeah.
And that's a huge difference. So I want to make sure that when I'm in charge, everyone in Congress works with things, not with words and ideas.
Well, let's hope that happens quickly. So
as soon as I'm in charge, it will happen.
No, I mean, you getting in charge happens quickly. Okay, let's. This is really good. I think it's a good way to start. Let's get into some of your concepts. You've written several books, Business Secrets of the Bible and Thou Shalt Prosper, two of my favorites. And in there, you talk about the Jewish traditions and biblical perspectives of earning and creating wealth and doing good work and things like that. I want to ask you a question. You know, in the business I'm in where I coach people, I typically, when someone comes to me, I ask them the question of, well, what do you want? You know, what do you want 3 to 5 years down the road? And it sounds like such a simple question, and yet it's very difficult to answer. People really haven't thought about that. And is there anything that you've come across in some of your teachings that is a reason that we are either reluctant to think about that, or either ashamed or self-conscious or uncomfortable to think about what's the vision for my life?
Well, the main reason why people are uncomfortable and are not able to simply spout out a simple answer to a simple question is because if I tell you what I want my life to look like in 5 years, I know what's going to happen next, and I'm not going to like it. What's going to happen next is you're going to tell me what I have to do in year 4, 3, 2, and 1. And then you're going to tell me what I have to do in months 12 through 1. And then you're going to tell me what I have to do tomorrow. And right now, my calendar is sort of fairly open. You know, I've got work. I just will do tomorrow pretty much like what I did today. The trouble is that if I behave today the same way I did yesterday, then tomorrow will be exactly the same as today. And so part of, you know, nobody wants to be tied down. The act of locking yourself into a program and a schedule and a calendar is not something that comes naturally and easily to us. What comes most easily to us is to simply slide into the groove and just do the same thing. And if necessary, inflation knocks 20% off our earning capacity. So, you know, we reduce our expenses a bit here and a bit there. But the job of saying, no, I am going to solve the inflation problem by increasing my revenue by 20% in the coming 12 months, that is the only way to effectively undo inflation. Now, that's harder. And intuitively, I know that making that commitment is going to be harder than just, hey, staying in the groove.
Yeah. Yeah. You said in your book, Thou Shalt Prosper, I have a quick quote here I thought was really valuable. You say, seeing oneself as having become an entirely new and different person is essential to any major growth step. And I've said for a long time, I don't know where I got it, maybe I got it from you, but the idea that if we want to radically improve our outcomes in life or our income, we have to become the person who earns that income and keeps that income and is comfortable with that income. And that whole becoming thing, could you speak on that a little bit and maybe cite some examples of how that works and why it's so important?
Right. Well, it's really important because money is made. And again, this is crucial. And I've been covering a lot of exactly that in the newest book, Bill. Ah. It's called The Holistic You. And what's important to clarify is that money is made only when two human beings interact. If that were not true, I'd attach my computer to my bank account and to my telephone, and I'd go boating and let my computer make money for me. It doesn't work that way. Nobody has succeeded in making that happen. We all want to generate passive streams of income, obviously, but that happens because I arrange to buy a building and the tenants pay me a rent on a regular basis. And even so, I need to interact with the tenants to keep them happy, and I've got to make sure that governmental regulations are complied with. So there's an awful lot of stuff that I'm still doing as a person. Now, this takes us to a fascinating and very fundamental question, which is identical twins have the identical DNA. That's why they're identical. It's either two little boys or two little girls, and they're absolutely identical. And there have been all kinds of wonderful twin studies. But the big question is, do you believe or think that identical twins have the same fingerprints as one another, or do they have separate fingerprints? And it's a massive question because many people haven't thought about it. But if you do think about it, you say to yourself, well, wait a second, they've got the identical DNA. And that means there is no source of data to produce anything different in one over the other. So obviously they must have the same fingerprints. But they don't.
They don't, yeah.
And that is a huge mystery. And when you ask evolutionary biologists to explain it, they come up with a word like wobbledygook. And you say, what's wobbledygook? And they, well, that's how it works. Their word is epigenetics. It doesn't mean anything at all, but that there has to be some explanation. And to me, the explanation is very simple, because I believe that we are creatures not only of body but of soul as well. And what is more, I believe, and I can demonstrate it beyond a shadow of a doubt, that much of what governs our lives is spiritual in nature. Not for, now, when I say spiritual, by the way, I'm not talking about godly or religious. I'm talking about things that do not respond to scientific inquiry, things that cannot be measured in a scientific lab. So, the very fact that you are wearing a beautiful tailored shirt and I'm wearing a beautiful tailored blazer with nice buttons, why aren't we wearing overalls? I got a pair of overalls, cost me $17. You probably paid five times that for your shirt. And my overalls, I can put them on. I'm fully dressed in less time than it takes you to button your shirt. Mm-hmm. I put my legs in. I put my arms in. I take the big brass zipper at my knees, zip it up to my right shoulder. I'm dressed. Why aren't we all wearing the utilitarian point of view? It keeps us clothed, keeps us protected, keeps us warm. It's cheap, it's quick. Why aren't we all wearing that? Because clothing is an expression of our innermost selves.
Yeah.
And yeah, it cannot be explained physically, only spiritually. And so when we realize that we are each unique to such an extent that even though there is no material explanation for separate fingerprints, and nonetheless, twins have separate fingerprints because they're not bodily prints. I call them soul prints. Their uniqueness stems from each of our uniqueness as an individual. And that's fundamental to trading. The whole reason eBay works is because I don't need my old sextant anymore and some young guy's going boating and wants my sextant. If we were all identical, none of us would ever trade. We'd all have exactly the same needs for everything at all the same time.
Yeah.
So the qualities that make it possible are, in fact, our spiritual underpinnings. And that is essentially what makes it possible for two individuals to talk to one another, form a relationship, connect, communicate, and then figure out how to collaborate, because that is how one and one can equal 11 or 23 or 97.
Yeah.
When two human beings, and de Tocqueville said this beautifully, he said the thing about America is that, he said this in the early 1800s, the thing about America is that you have groups, alliances, organizations, you have PTAs and church groups and boys. This is a remarkable thing, he said, because when a lot of human beings can cooperate on a common goal, anything can happen. And this is why the corporation emerged in the Western world, the world shaped by the Bible. The corporation didn't show up in tribal societies. The corporation showed up in the 1600s in England and in Holland. And the corporation makes it possible for people to connect and collaborate and devise ways to achieve the goal that they all wish to attain.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Their new book, The Holistic You, can you give me, I've not read it yet, and so I need to get a copy of it. So we'll link to the Amazon link in the show notes. What's one important concept? You wrote the book for a reason. You still had something to say after two awesome or many other books. What's the number one or two concepts that I will get out of that in your words today?
First of all, I think I'd say that many people, and this doesn't apply to you, I know, but there are many people who believe that while they're spending attention on their spouse and their children, there's a part of them that is agitated because it's time away from work. And there are people who sometimes get impatient with time spent socially. I've got to remind myself, my wife asks me, we're supposed to have dinner with this other couple. And I think, really? I mean, there was a book I was planning on reading that night. I wasn't planning on a social dinner. And I have to remind myself, in fact, I often go back to the relevant chapter and remind myself, these things all interact with one another. This is not a book about balance in life. Balance in life is easy. Yeah, I realize I got to go to the gym, right? I go to the gym, right? It's time away from work. Yeah, obviously it is. Same reason I go to the dentist when I have to. You do what you got to do. Balance in life is simple and straightforward. Pretty much everyone can figure that out. But what we don't necessarily always get is the extent to which these things play into one another. And so the extent to which a young man focuses on work has an impact on his family connections, because the choice of women he has to date and ultimately mate with is much higher.
Yeah.
Because women are built to be nest builders. Now, there are all kinds of scientific names, psychological names. They speak of hypergamy. But, everyone knows the basic idea is that a guy who has a few dollars in the bank obviously has far greater choice in women to select. And likewise, it's also true that a man who has a good woman is going to perform at a far higher level in business than the single guy. Apart from anything else, he's not spending the same amount of time catting around. But apart from that, we are built. We are created to be more effective givers than takers. Being takers corrodes our souls. It on a deep level, it bothers us. Yeah. And I can prove that because welfare recipients in America or people who are on the dole in England, they should be the happiest, most grateful people because they've perfected the art of living on their fellow citizens' backs. But they're not.
Yeah.
And the reason is because being a taker makes you miserable. Being a giver is a huge generative force in our souls. And so when a man is working and he's supporting a wife and children, the level at which he performs is immeasurably higher than it is when he's working for himself in order to afford a new car.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, quite different.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I'm in a men's group and we meet Mondays at noon at a guy's office. And I just started in this group here a few weeks ago. And I know when I leave that room, I feel better. And it's because I watch us all contribute to each other. If we have pain or if we have dilemmas or got to make decisions, and I watch five or six guys come together, not to be guys, but people come together and help each other. And it almost like it revives the spirit within us. Speaking to your point about connection and companies. And
by the way, sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to say that from my point of view, I would insist that it does need to be guys. And for women, it needs to be women.
Yeah,
I know it's you know, politically, who cares? Let's talk the truth here. And yes, for a guy to be involved with a guy's group is immensely valuable.
Well, Rabbi, we really appreciate you being on today. We'll put the link to the book, The Holistic You, in our show notes. And it's always a pleasure and a gift to be able to spend a little bit of time with you. And so thank you so much. And maybe we can do this again sometime.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to see you again. And I look forward to next time. Take care.
Thanks.